Now, does this mean that Tibetan Buddhism will disappear completely? Does it mean that no vestige of Tibetan Buddhism will remain? Personally, I don't think so. As I've said, Tibetan Buddhism, as the way of life of a whole nation, a whole people, a nationwide community, has in fact already come to an end. And I do not think that there can be any question of its revival. But Tibetan Buddhism will survive to a limited extent in at least two ways. First of all, it will survive among the Tibetan refugees in India and elsewhere. And secondly, it will survive as an integral part of Buddhism in the West. Now, for us, the second of these is the more important, and I'm therefore going to discuss it in some detail. But before I do that, just a few words about the first, about the survival of Tibetan Buddhism among Tibetan refugees. Most of the Tibetan refugees, as you probably know, there are about 100,000 of them altogether, are found in India, mainly in the hill areas. Quite understandably, the Tibetans, coming from a very high country, most of it around 12,000 feet, haven't been very happy settling down in the hot plains of India. So as far as possible, they've clung to the hills. They try to settle down around the Himalayas, either in the east or in the west, or even in the central portion. So most of them are still there, places like Darjeeling, like Kalimpong, Sikkim, Dalhousie, various other places in the Punjab, even as far up as Kashmir. This is where they've tended to settle down. And altogether there are about 100,000 of them. There are some, of course, in Europe. Most European countries, I think most Western European countries, do now harbour a few Tibetan refugees, especially Switzerland. In Switzerland, there's a concentration of altogether 1,000 Tibetan refugees. This is the biggest community outside India itself. Amongst the 100,000 who are refugees, whether in India or in the West, there are perhaps some 2,000 monks of various grades, lay brothers, fully ordained monks, novices, geishas, abbots, and so on. Altogether, so far as one can estimate, about 2,000 refugee monks amongst a total of around 100,000 refugees in general. Now, for refugees everywhere, whether the Tibetans or any others, the first question, the first consideration is that of physical survival. And this is obviously the first question by which the Tibetan refugees themselves are faced. They have to attend first of all to that. First of all, they have to eat. And for many of them, that is still quite a difficult business, as many are still working on the roads, still road making, for the government, government of India, and getting just a pittance for that, and managing with extreme difficulty to keep body and soul together. So this is naturally what must engage, first of all, their consideration. But conditions are improving. Very, very few Tibetan refugees in India do suffer physical hardship, and something is beginning to be done to preserve the Tibetan culture and Tibetan form of Buddhism. In several places, Tibetan Buddhist temples and monasteries have been started. I remember in the course of my own tour, I visited one at Saranath and another at Buddhagaya, temples, monasteries, built fairly recently by the Tibetans, especially by the refugees. At one particular place in West Bengal called Baksar, 1,000 Gelugpa monks are staying together. Now you might be wondering how on earth they managed to find a building big enough for 1,000 monks. But they aren't staying in a building, they're staying in an old army camp. And they've got an army man, a military man, as commandant of the camp. And he runs it more or less along military lines. And that is not dissimilar to the way in which monasteries are, or were, run in Tibet. And I'm told that the monks get on with him very well indeed. Again, in Dalhousie, the two tantric colleges have been reopened in a number of small bungalows, and about 200 monks are there. And there are, up and down India, but especially in the north, and especially in the foothills of the of the Himalayas, quite a number of smaller settlements. So as I've said here, temples, monasteries are being built, monks are residing, so there's some hope of the culture and the religion of the Tibetan people surviving. A number of handicraft centres have also been opened by the Tibetan refugees, and these centres are producing paintings, carpets, metalwork, woodwork, and so on, along traditional lines. Inevitably, unfortunately, there's been some corruption in the matter of colour and design, but something is at least being continued, and no doubt improvements will be made. So there's no doubt that Tibetan Buddhism, like the Tibetan refugees themselves, will survive in exile. In India, I think the position of Tibetan Buddhism in time will be not unlike that of Zoroastrianism among the Parsis of Bombay. I don't know how many of you have heard about the Parsis of Bombay, but they're a very flourishing Indian community. About 1,000 years ago, their ancestors fled from Persia, from Iran, and came to India. They fled because at that time Islam was invading Persia, and it was a question of being converted to Islam or perishing. So a number of Zoroastrians, a number of followers of the ancient teaching of Zoroaster, the great Persian prophet, they decided that they neither wanted to embrace Islam nor did they want to perish, so they just fled. And they came by sea from Persia, through Arabia, to Bombay, 1,000 years ago. And the Indians received them kindly, as the Indians do usually receive refugees kindly, especially religious refugees, received them kindly. They were given land in and around the Bombay area. Of course, in those days, there was no city of Bombay, but the area was the same. They settled down, and they engaged in trade. And now, 1,000 years later, there are some 30,000 of them, and they're probably one of the richest, if not the richest, community in the whole of India. Only 30,000, although they don't have any poor person amongst them. Their social arrangements are so good. You never find a poor Parsi. You never find a Parsi beggar. And of course, in India, that is really something. You can find Brahmin beggars. You can find Hindu beggars. You can find Muslim beggars. You can find Christian beggars even, but you won't find a Parsi beggar, because every individual Parsi is so well looked after by the community. And it is a practice amongst the Parsis that when they die, very often they leave their money, and sometimes they're very, very wealthy indeed, to be distributed amongst the entire community. Their community organization keeps a register of all Parsis. And if someone dies and leaves, say, 2 million, then that's distributed amongst the entire Parsi community. Everybody gets 10 rupees or 12 rupees or 15 rupees per head. This is their system. It's not obligatory, but it is very, very often done. So the result is that the Parsi community is enterprising, highly educated, very charitable. They put out lots of dispensaries and lots of hospitals in Bombay, and they preserve, above all, their ancient Zoroastrian faith. Zoroastrianism has perished from Persia. You find hardly a trace of it there. Just one or two areas in the hills, you find a few Persians clinging on to the ancient Zoroastrian faith in the midst of the all-pervading Islam. But in Bombay, you find this strong and resilient Parsi community preserving the Parsi faith when it has perished practically elsewhere in the world. So probably something like this will happen with regard to Tibetan Buddhism in India. There are 100,000 Tibetan Buddhist refugees, and no doubt Tibetan Buddhism will be preserved amongst them, especially as they have amongst them these 2,000 monks. In Tibet itself, if the Chinese communists remain, as it looks that they will remain for any length of time, for a few more generations, then very likely Tibetan Buddhism will entirely disappear. But sometimes we don't like to think that a religion can disappear, that it can be wiped out, but it can. I remember some years ago I read a very interesting book on Manichaeism, the teaching of the Prophet Mani. At one time, the teachings of the Prophet Mani, a sort of universalist, all-embracing religion, spread from France to China, right across Europe and Asia. But now, it just doesn't exist. It was simply wiped out. And the person who wrote this book, it was Duncan Greenlees, made the point. He said people don't usually appreciate, or they're reluctant to appreciate, the fact that a religion can be wiped out. And this is what happened with Manichaeism. It was wiped out. It was wiped out by Persian kings. It was wiped out by the Roman Catholic Church. It was wiped out by Chinese emperors. It was a very inoffensive faith. This is perhaps why they didn't like it. It believed in complete non-violence. It believed in love and so on and so forth. But nobody liked it. It wasn't very popular. Everybody wanted to stamp it out. So they did stamp it out. As I say, popes and Chinese emperors and whatnot, they stamped out this religion. So sometimes a religion is stamped out. It can be stamped out. This can happen. So we mustn't think that we'll know that Tibetan Buddhism is so great, so glorious, God won't allow it to be stamped out. Well, if there is a God, well, he can. He is able to do this, to allow a religion to be stamped out. This has happened with Buddhism in Mongolia. About China we don't know very much, but we do know quite a lot about Mongolia. Mongolia was an even more staunchly Buddhist country than Tibet. As I think I mentioned in the course of one of the talks, the Mongolian geishas are even more learned than their Tibetan counterparts. But from about 1920, communism was introduced into Mongolia under Russian auspices, long before it came to China, with the result that nowadays Buddhism, Mongolian Buddhism, which is a form of Tibetan Buddhism, cannot really be said to exist. Yes, a few temples, a few monasteries are preserved as museums. A few old monks still potter around on state pensions. But that's about all. Buddhism in Mongolia has virtually ceased to exist. And the same may well happen in Tibet. So one isn't being unduly pessimistic. One isn't being unnecessarily gloomy. One is just trying to face facts. And this would seem to me to be part of a sort of general tendency in Asia. If one looks over Asia, if one looks over the East, it's as though Buddhism is capitulating at right and left. China is lost to Buddhism for all intents and purposes. So is Tibet. So is Mongolia. Burma is threatened. Thailand probably will be threatened. Japan isn't threatened from without, but threatened from within by over-industrialization. Buddhism does still exist there to some extent, but not as it existed perhaps before. And in other parts of the East, you find Islam came several hundred years ago, swept Buddhism away. So for hundreds of years, it seems, Buddhism has been on the defensive. And in many areas, communism is giving the last touch, as it were, and it is finally crumbling. And this is one of the reasons why I feel it is so important for us here in the West to study and to practice, and if possible, to preserve Buddhism. It might seem a fantastic thought, but it may come true. It may be so one day that there will be very little Buddhism in the East, but perhaps something at least here in the West. Bigger changes have taken place than this in world history. We mustn't think that because the East was Buddhist for 2,000 years, it's going to be Buddhist forever and ever. So far as we can see, in all countries, in all Buddhist countries of the East, Buddhism is on the defensive, if not in retreat, if not actually vanquished, if not actually obliterated. This is the picture there. So these are the sort of facts that we do have to face. So it may well be that Tibetan Buddhism survives in India, just as Zoroastrianism has survived in India too. This is, of course, not going into the question of India's own fate, which is quite another question, but into that I don't propose to enter. There is, of course, the danger that even if, or even when, Tibetan Buddhism does succeed in surviving on a reduced scale in India, there's the danger that it becomes a sort of museum piece, a sort of bit of archaeology, like the Red Indians in the United States, and so on. But perhaps one need not speculate about that at present.